The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
I should be writing season 20, episode 11.
Well, I should be writing. I should be working on my craft. I should be writing. I should be submitting my next draft. But I'm sitting watching Doctor.
Hi there. Welcome to I Should Be Writing. This is a podcast for wannabe fiction writers, and I'm your host, Mer Lafferty. Usually I have, I'm solo, but I'm delighted to have an author on the show with me today. It is Scott Alexander Howard, author of The Other Valley, which is a lit fic slash science fiction speculative slash magical realism maybe slash book. I have many questions to talk to you about genre, actually, but welcome to the show. We're glad to have you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Usually we talk about what I talk about what I've been up to, just because the show's called I Should Be Writing, so I try to keep myself honest. To be honest, I'm still cleaning up after last week's vacation, so I've kind of gotten everything, all the fires that were on fire, they're put out, and hopefully I'll be able to get to writing tomorrow, but hasn't been a good brain week. I will have to say that. Scott, can you tell us what you're working on? And if you don't want to, that is absolutely cool.
Oh, no, it's cool. I am working on my second book, and I don't even know. I'm terrible at counting drafts. I find it kind of arbitrary in terms of my method. And it's kind of confusing because this one's kind of coming out very differently than the first one did. So whatever method of counting drafts I had established is now out the window too. But it's coming along. Mm-hmm. This one is kind of forming in my head a lot more than on the page, at least compared to the first book. But that is what I'm doing. Sort of like, maybe I'm on the first draft, maybe I'm on the third.
Yeah. The thing that frustrates me is when people ask you how long it takes you to write a book. That is such a nebulous question to me. It's like, first draft, second draft, thinking about it while I'm in the shower, rewriting, I don't know. I really don't. So I get you on the draft versions. My husband's a software engineer, and he suggested he just like set up a versioning system for me that engineers use. And I've thought about it. I've thought about taking him up on that. But if anybody in the chat, or if you're listening later, has any good news to share, please let me know. The yay button is up and primed, and we love to hear good news, and including rejections, because rejections mean you're a working author. So we cheer for that. And I know our good friend Pauline has good news, but I don't know if she's here. Actually, she usually doesn't watch in the afternoon, does she? Anyway, we've had some sales in the Discord community, so that is excellent news. But if anybody has any news, let me know, and we will get started with that. I told you I'm having a bad brain day. Sorry about this, Scott.
Oh, no, it's fine.
You had, this is your debut, and it's got, like, super fancy people blurbing it, and it's been optioned already, and that's... just how exciting is that, and how daunting is that as your debut?
It's weird because I've had a long time to kind of get undaunted by it, you know, because publishing is so slow.
Sure.
And so, you know, it's been finished and sold for, you know, almost 2 years at this point. So I think that the excitement now is kind of like in the rearview mirror, I mean, then again, it just got published a few weeks ago, so there's a whole new flurry of that. But I think I've kind of slowly been the frog in the boiling water with it, and kind of gotten used to the a different pitch of life. It's a little bit more busy and social than it had been. I was very much like an isolated writer when I was doing this. I was working as a freelance copy editor. This is just, my life was just an inbox and like Word files, and didn't have like a writing community. So once this started to take off, it's just been kind of interesting on the social level to have so many more people, like, agents and editors and publicists and stuff in my life than there were before.
I'm absolutely I've talked about excitement fatigue, because the one time I got to announce an option, they decided to announce it after they'd renewed it once. So I was about 2 years into the option, and suddenly I took a nap and I woke up to a flurry of excitement, and I'm like, what's going on? And they're like, they pointed me to the link that said this book had been optioned, and I'm like, right, I was excited about that about 2 years ago. I just didn't tell anybody. It's a weird thing.
It was the same for me too. Like the option happened, or the deal closed, only a few months after the book sold, and but that was, again, almost 2 years ago at this point. And it just got announced in the trades, like, I think in Deadline a few weeks ago. So yeah, I had a similar experience. I think mine was also held up by the writer's strike.
Oh,
Everything
yeah.
was put on pause for that too.
Yeah. And, yeah, so I'm curious to hear about your history with fiction, because you came at it through a PhD in philosophy and a postdoctoral fellow at Harvard, and you've worked on the relationship between memory, emotion, and literature. Is this the first time that's like blossomed into fiction, or do you have shorter things that we can look up?
There is nothing. I haven't published any fiction before this. But that,
Wow.
yeah. But it's not to say that I wasn't working on it. Like, it was kind of basically my path is a kind of perverse one, where fiction was the plan A when I was a kid and a teenager, and for a variety of reasons, sort of erroneously thinking that maybe academia was more stable and secure. And that's actually not true of academia. It's very difficult to have a career in it. But I went into philosophy partly as a practical consideration, partly because I was, obviously I was interested in it too, but that was sort of the deciding factor between trying to make it as a writer, and trying to go into academia where I could become a professor, hopefully. And then the work I was doing as a philosopher was always kind of sort of strange as far as the philosophical mainstream was concerned. I was doing stuff that was considered to be highly literary, and I had a lot of philosophers would say, like, this isn't really philosophy. You're kind of doing, comparative literature or something like that. And so I was kind of pursuing this wobbly compromise in academia, trying to sort of keep one foot within my, my love of fiction, my love of literature, and still also, meet the standards of the philosophical mainstream, which didn't really work. I got like some, I got some support from philosophers. I'm not gonna underplay it, but I think it was still kind of like a, it was going to be a sort of a strange, lonely life for me as like a niche kind of cult interest in philosophy. And then as soon as I decided to give it up and just try writing the novel that I'd been thinking about for years at that point, it's really kind of felt like much more like coming home. It kind of clicked, like, ah, this is what I should have been doing the whole time. So from plan A to plan B to plan A again, later in life.
That's great. I'm very curious. So, are there books about philosophy? Are there novels about philosophy that fit better than what they were critiquing you about? Or were they saying philosophy doesn't fit into novels at all? Which sounds weird, because most philosophy I've heard is storytelling is used to explain it.
Yeah, I think that what I was kind of doing was, it's such a weird thing to think about in retrospect, but I was kind of mining the literary canon for examples. I would take like a haiku or something from Virginia Woolf, and I would plunk it into a philosophical context where people are. So my field was basically the emotions. I worked on emotions and memory. And a lot of the philosophers who discuss emotions were talking about, you know, they would just sort of use like stick person examples of emotions. They're like, okay, so John fears a dog. Is the fear justified? Well, it depends if the dog is actually dangerous or not. You know, it's very kind of simple, dry ways of talking about, you know, the justification of emotions. And I would sort of take these more poetic examples from To the Lighthouse or The Waves and say, okay, well, you can make this kind of discussion work when you're restricting it to stick person examples. But what happens when you consider more full-fledged, interesting emotions that are, you know, undeniably there, that we all experience, but the philosophers weren't really engaging with. And my argument was that the philosophical discourse that we have, that the apparatus that they've built in that field to talk about emotional justification, was actually pretty poorly equipped to talk about the full range of emotions that we experience, especially in literature. So that was kind of the way I was talking about it and why it didn't really fit. You know, I think that because my conclusion was that philosophers were sort of doing this wrong, it's not surprising that I didn't get a job in philosophy. They're like, we love that. Anyway, next.
that's fair. But isn't that what, like, new? I've never been in a real scientific think tank kind of place, but it just feels like I think this thing might be wrong. Let me study it and see what's going on. Isn't that how this everything moves forward?
It should be. It should be, but it's not always. I think that I don't want to represent myself as such a huge rebel that I was going in there with this destructive agenda, and that people weren't ready for it or something like that. Like, that's kind of a heroic narrative to put on just professional floundering. But I think that there is a kernel of truth to that, that it wasn't entirely welcome, which is ironic because, you know, Socrates was kind of a shit disturber as well. You know? I'm not comparing myself to him or that stature, but I think that, you know, the foundations of the discipline are sort of in showing how the ways we have of thinking about things are not always adequate to the topics. And yet the profession as it stands right now tends to be much more like positive and theory building in its mentality, rather than wanting to face that sometimes our theories kind of run aground just where things get interesting.
Wow. I wish you had been able to shake up philosophy a little bit more, because I agree that the emotions are pretty powerful. But I'm glad you wrote this book, because I'm enjoying the hell out of it. Do you want to give us the basic rundown of what it is?
Thank you. Yeah, it's so The Other Valley. It's about a valley. It takes place in a small town beside a lake in a valley. And the conceit is that across the mountains to the east, the same valley reappears, the same town reappears within it, but there it's 20 years in the future. And if you are to walk across the western mountains, same thing, same town, except there it's 20 years in the past. And this goes on in either direction forever. So it's a kind of time travel book where time travel is simply terrestrial ground travel. You know, you get to the past, the future, just by walking there. There's no machine, there's no portal. It's very kind of rustic and rudimentary. And in this world, travel is strictly prohibited, except, so there's, you know, there's like fences, there's armed guards. You're not allowed to cross the borders between these towns. But there's kind of one exception, which is if you are grieving, you can petition sort of the municipal government for permission to leave. And you can go to the past 20 years ago. And you're escorted by armed guards. Once you get there, the point is to be able to kind of take one last look at the person that you've lost, who is dead in your town, but is still alive and healthy in the town of the past. And once you're there, you have to wear a mask. You're not allowed to be recognized. You're not allowed to interact with this person. So they don't know who you are. They just see somebody in a mask at a distance. But you can stand there for a little while and watch them as a kind of consolation, you know, like a last viewing. And some people find it consoling and some people don't. But what catalyzes the story is there's a 16-year-old girl named Odile who's very shy. She's standing beside her school one day and she sees some of these visitors from the future in masks kind of hanging out near her school with their police escort. But she accidentally recognizes who they are. You know, somebody's mask comes up for a second. And that allows her to put together which one of her classmates they must be here to see, and thus which one of her classmates must be about to die. And only Odile knows this fact, you know, she and the municipal government. So what she does with this secret foreknowledge kind of changes the course of her life, and we follow her into adulthood, 20 years into the future. And
hey, everybody, I have a bit of embarrassing news. When we recorded this, Twitch decided to run an ad at this point. And what I did not realize was it also stopped recording at this point. They don't tell you that. So while in the future I'll be trying really hard to make sure we take a break when the ads come, there is a broken part here, and I'm sorry.
Yeah, basically about, I think there's kind of a kernel of truth to all of those, and like when I was querying, because I was cold querying, I didn't have any, you know, connections or referrals, so that was kind of when I really had to confront how am I going to try to package this, because I wrote it in sort of a blissful, like, who cares mentality, like, oh, well, genre will sort itself out. And then I was like, oh no, I have to actually package this for someone like who's giving this, you know, 2 seconds of their attention. And so I think I tried to use comps to signify where it fit in the genre space. I think I called it literary speculative to some people, and I called it sci-fi to more sort of sci-fi oriented agents.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I said it was something like I was like, imagine an Elena Ferrante narrator in a Ted Chiang world. You know,
just oh, kind of wow.
Try to bridge that, like, okay, so we have like a very literary or upmarket kind of voice, but we're not afraid of having like a sort of speculative world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think a lot of people worry a little too early about the genre. Because I'm like you, it's like the stuff that I just kind of wrote has always been more... has always been better received than stuff I fret about all the little pieces before it's really time. But I mean, does your agent rep a lot of science fiction authors, or do they do most more lit fic, or?
Yeah, more lit fic. And I mean, honestly, a lot of like nonfiction as well.
Mm-hmm.
I think that we were kind of, I was able to choose between two agents, and I chose my agent partly because I think she was the most open to me writing in a variety of genres.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, this one happens to be has a speculative element or whatever, any number of those other descriptors we talked about. Whereas I think the new one is shaping up to be a little bit more of a real world setting. And, you know, I think that's a freedom that I really wanted to have.
Yeah. So can we talk about the agent hunt real quick?
Sure.
You sounded like you were definitely not sounding like a debut there, because you knew what you had to ask the agent, because I think, how do you see my career turning out, or are you open to X, Y, and Z in the future? I think it's something not a lot of people focus on when they're thinking about their agent. So did you interview them, and how was that process?
Yeah, I think you kind of interview each other. They're trying to make sure that you're not going to be a difficult author to work with,
right?
And I want to make sure that this is like the person who's best positioned to sort of like sell my books down the road as well as now. Yeah, I mean, I only knew to ask that because I was sort of obsessively reading online things about what to ask.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I didn't have any great career acumen. I was just getting it from like other people's YouTube videos, like, okay, here's what you do in the call. And people always say, like, oh, when you're querying, you have to really do your research, you know, and I think that's true, but ultimately there's only so much research you can do. You know, it does become a numbers game.
Yeah.
In terms of who you're sending it to. But yeah, I found querying to be kind of a daunting, depressing process, like most people do, I think.
Yeah.
You know,
how did you keep your spirits up while you were doing it?
You know, I didn't, is the short answer. I think my spirits are pretty down. I think that I did it in batches. You know, I'd sort of send out like 10 or 12, and then I would wait for, you know, however long. I think it was kind of like a month and a half before I would sort of try again. And between the first and the second batch, I really retooled the whole query letter, really shaved it down, made it much more kind of character focused, rather than it's tough with speculative fiction, because I think you have a an extra burden. Same with fantasy, anything that's not just realist. You know, you all of us only have a certain amount of words. You know, you got your 200 or 250, but anybody who's able to say like, yeah, mine is about this character in the real world, that's, you save a lot of time. Whereas mine is like, okay, here's the world and here's the character and here's the story.
Mm-hmm.
Plus here's my comps and so forth. So there's an extra kind of burden, I think, that gets placed on you. So I found that to be difficult. But once I finally did get some full manuscript requests about 5 months in, around like the kind of 30 to 40 queries mark.
Wow.
And yeah, it's interesting. I didn't get, so I'm Canadian, or I'm a dual citizen, I'm Canadian American, but I live here in Canada. And I kind of thought my entryway might be through Canadian agents. And there's not very many of them because it's a pretty small market. You know, it's a small, huge country with not a lot of people in it.
Right.
And so there's not a big pool of agents, especially once you kind of winnow it down to those who are looking for your kind of work and are open for queries at this time. But I still got no attention from Canadian agents.
Wow.
Both the offers I had were from the States.
So when you were, you did say you wrote this in a sort of blissed out way. What did you do to deal with the normal roadblocks we all suffer with writing? Either there always seems to be a roadblock around 35,000 words where people are just like, nope, wait, this is all crap. And then they forget that every other time they wrote a book, it was crap at 35,000 words, or just feeling like you've had too many rejections and it's time to quit. Like, how did you, like, if you didn't keep your spirits up, how did you continue to move on?
I feel like my spirits were pretty okay during the writing process. In a way, I might have benefited from not having sent in, like, I didn't have a bunch of rejections for short stories, for example, or mm-hmm. for previous novels. You know, I was writing this completely from scratch, and there was really no, it was very abstract. You know, the idea of publication was like this kind of vague thing. So I didn't have like a big emotional kind of, I don't know, distraction from those thoughts, I guess. But I think that just in terms of the intrinsic experience of writing and the difficulties that you hit at that midway point, I don't know. There was a lot of challenges with the writing of the book. I think that in my book, so in The Other Valley, it's kind of bifurcated into two parts, and there's a big jump between the parts. So in the first half, Odile is 16, and the kind of time span we're looking at is quite short. You know, it's a pretty condensed, the first half of the book is condensed into a shorter amount of time. And then in the second half, we jump forward, and she's 35, about to turn 36. And the time, the sort of like the pace changes, it kind of traverses a year rather than just a few weeks. And that was a big challenge, I think. Just, again, it wasn't so much like an emotional trial. It was just like a very sticky problem in terms of conceptualizing the book and trying to figure out, you know, basically, I got used to the pace that the first half had. You know, it was very much like a daily kind of, here's the experience of living in this world, here's what she's going through. And then when I realized that the second half, I couldn't use that same pace, I had to figure out some other way of doing it. And it took me a long time to sort of solve that practical problem of being like, okay, it's going to kind of go over four seasons for her. We're going to sort of jump into sort of 1 week per season, roughly. And that way I can maintain that same intimacy where I'm talking about like, here's her daily life in these few days, so I can kind of keep that time compression, but also then kind of skip forward a few months, and in that way also canvas this larger time period for her. So a lot of practical problems, you know, and sort of trying to sustain, I think, the reader's interest over that seam in the middle of the book was also a challenge, because I really sort of, I don't know if you saw The Wire, that's a, you know, a show that really changed up its cast of characters
right.
to a large extent every season. And this book does that a little bit too. You know, the first half, I, for various reasons, I jettison a lot of the context, you know, and I think that some readers have said to me that they, you know, reach that halfway point, and as soon as they see what's happening in the second half, they're like, oh no, you know, I miss where I was. Why can't I get back there? And that was a very deliberate choice. I wanted the readers sort of miss childhood in the same way that the character misses childhood. I wanted that loss to be felt by the reader as well. But there's still a challenge there in terms of, okay, if I'm really kind of hitting you in the gut here, How do I keep you turning the pages? How do I kind of continue to reward the reader's attention when a lot of the emotional attachments have actually been taken away, at least for a little while? So that was also a challenge. And I think I tried to solve it by letting you in a lot more about into the mechanics of the world. So in exchange for, you know, losing a bit of the social context that you were kind of ensconced in the first half, you do now get to see a lot more of the way that this, the sort of the metaphysics of the world work, the politics and the laws of the world work. It's no longer through a child's perspective, so we can actually kind of get a bit more information. And that sort of sustains you over that hump, I think.
Mm-hmm. So how did your I'm just still just fascinated by this background in philosophy and emotions. How did it affect how you're writing it? Do you think you went back to your studies and everything to sort of give your book a sort of, oh, words are failing me now, just an underlying foundation?
Yes and no. I think that when I left academia, I was pretty burnt out. And so I conceived of this as being very much like, you know, I didn't read philosophy for a few years after I left. I was just mm-hmm. like, I was so tired of it. I've been doing nothing but that for years and years and years. And so I sort of saw this book as this wonderful escape from that stuff. And then it's funny to see now how much of it is actually still there, you know, like, yeah. I think I was walking out the door not looking back, but I think a lot of it was still kind of stuck to my shoe. And so I think that, I don't know, the influence of philosophy on it, I think stylistically maybe is hopefully pretty modest, because a lot of philosophers, I had one professor who said philosophers write like dogs, and I think that's maybe generous to philosophers sometimes. You know, there's some pretty bad writing that you have to put out, and there's also some brilliant stylists, but you know, it's often not, that's not the first kind of, I think there's a certain kind of badge of honor within the discipline of being a bad writer. I don't know why.
Really?
So yeah, I think that it's kind of, it shows that you're, and again, there's some great writing. I don't want to crap on philosophy too much, but there's some people who I think they view you with suspicion if something is elegant. They kind of prize an aesthetic of ultra dry, dogged sort of logic, you know, like it's just a style.
So the kind of human readable stuff for people like me to understand, they would not appreciate?
No, it's like, at least in the kind of in the upper echelons of the best journals, you know, in philosophy, there's sometimes, at least in analytic philosophy, yeah, I think it's really kind of supposed to be opaque to anybody, except if you've been kind of like really, really saturated in the field. And that's pretty normal.
So philosophers are like tax lawyers and accountants. They all the laws have to be really obscure so people like me can't figure it out, and we need people like them.
Yeah, I wonder if I think this is true of academia in some ways, that there is this in-group, out-group mentality. You know, like I think that's the reason. I mean, capitalism plays a role too, but I think that, you know, it's a crime that journals are paywalled. You know, like this is, all of us, you know, we pay taxes. A lot of that money goes into higher education, especially in Canada, where we have fewer private universities. All this money comes out of the people and into the universities, and then it gets kind of sheltered there because you can't actually read the journals that who work there are publishing in, because they're subscription only, and you know, they try to charge you $50 to read one article. You know,
right.
So I think there is definitely an element of kind of hoarding knowledge. I think some of it is also less nefarious and more just kind of a byproduct of any very high level of professionalism, where people are only kind of talking to each other, and so they develop their own parlance. So maybe that's not like intentionally shutting people out so much as just they've evolved in this niche, and so they've kind of developed their own jargon that only they understand.
Yeah. Well, that's irritating.
Yeah, I will say on the more positive side, I think that the stuff that's the most philosophical in my book that I can recognize is sort of stuff that I think it's certainly not unique to this book. You know, I think a lot of sci-fi especially, you know, takes on these questions. So I can sort of recognize there's a lot of writing about the nature of personal identity in philosophy. And I think that that's something that, that sci-fi has really explored too.
Right.
So there's echoes of these kinds of thought experiments, like, you know, okay, well, if you take this, these memories and put them into a different person, has that person, does that person survive in their new body, or is this a whole new person? There's kinds of questions that are along those lines in this book, you know, not that exact scenario, but still that are recognizably philosophical, but I think also have a long history within speculative fiction too.
Yeah, the old Theseus's boat discussion.
Mm-hmm.
So what books do you think have inspired you along this way? Because your book, it seems to do that magical thing of remind you of something and yet still feel unique, which is very difficult to do. So can you say if there were any books that inspired you?
Yeah, well, thank you. I think that some of the books that inspired... So, I mean, I mentioned my little comp. So I definitely was mm-hmm. influenced by the Ferrante Neapolitan novels. I think that also the Ted Chiang stuff. You know, he's so good because he's got this, like, marvelous economy.
Yeah, he's brilliant.
And, yeah, it's so brilliant. And yet it's, in addition to the brainy sort of satisfactions of it, it's almost always really heartfelt and kind of humanist. And so that was an inspiration too, you know, like realizing that I could combine those things, that it wasn't just an either or between like a very, you know, like I think Borges is kind of similar to Chiang in some ways, but Borges, I think the rewards are purely intellectual for the most part, whereas Chiang sort of speaks to the heart and the head equally. I think Ishiguro was a big influence. You know, the sort of like Never Let Me Go has this elegiac but understated dystopia. That's something that was inspiring to me.
Yeah, I saw that in a lot of the descriptions of your book. People use that as comps.
Yeah, yeah. I certainly, I don't mind that. I mean, it's just an honor to be, you know, in the same sentence as him. I think he's just so good. I think that Yoko Ogawa's The Memory Police was sort of a book that I read. That was a bit of an... And it was something that I didn't read beforehand. I was reading it midway through writing. And so you can't call it like an influence per se, but it was an aha moment where I was like, okay, this kind of world counts as literary. This sort of eerie tone that doesn't feel the need to over-explain itself. It just establishes this dream world that we then play out as realism in a way. That was also like, okay, I'm glad that someone else, you know, got away with this too.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, yeah, I mean, I've got... Sorry, go ahead.
No, you go.
I think something that I haven't talked about before is maybe like more of an unpredictable one, but I think that like when I was writing it, I thought a lot about Marilynne Robinson's Housekeeping. So that's her first novel from ages ago. Not so much about like the tone of the plot, but simply because I come from pretty close to there. So this book takes place, I think in the town Fingerbone is based on Sandpoint, Idaho, or something like that. And it's just across the border to the south from where I grew up. And it's a similar kind of weird ecosystem. You know, you've got a kind of very arid mountains and then these like deep glacial lakes. And it was kind of inspiring to me that, you know, just fantastic literature could come out of the part of the world that I'm from, because it's not I don't come from New York, so there's not like a ton of literary history to draw on and feel like I'm kind of standing on the shoulders of giants. You know, it was very much like an underrepresented, you know, geographical locale. Mm-hmm. So it was nice to realize that about her.
Excellent. Well, this is your first book. Is there, I know it's kind of been a wild trip for you. Is there anything you wish someone would have told you?
It's funny because this is sort of a book about the perils of foreknowledge.
Yeah, so that's true.
I think that like it's probably good that I was pretty ignorant going in. I think it would have been nice to like if I had had a crystal ball, had I known that I would eventually find representation for it, that would have saved me a lot of grief. You know, that would have saved me like a lot of self-doubt.
Yeah.
You know, I do all of my work basically other than the actual drafting. I do in a all-purpose free writing file. It's just like a diary of both of my life and of the book. And every day I start by writing in it. And the free writing file that starts the year that I sold this book, the first entry that I would see every time I opened the file says, "I'm utterly convinced that the book is bad." And that's a few months before, you know, I got an agent and the book sold and I got option, all these, you know, wonderful things. But I was just utterly anywhere. And so it would have been nice to have had some kind of inkling of the future, just to spare me that kind of, you know, those dark nights of the soul.
Yeah.
But as far as, yeah, the practicalities of things, I think it's just like, it's inevitably a learning process. So that's, I guess that's the main foreknowledge I would say.
Well, excellent. We have some questions popping up in the chat, so we're going to turn to that. Let's see. There's a lot of positive discussion. This book sounds like a mind breaker. Yeah, sorry. There was discussion about technical problems. I didn't see that. Whoops. Sorry, guys. I'm glad you got it worked out. Yeah, a lot of people interested in the book. The Kids Are Asleep asks, would you say the location in your book functions as a character as well in terms of having a personality, maybe their own arc?
It certainly functions as an important feature of the book. I mean, the entire thing is based around landscape. The landscape is drawn from the landscape where I grew up, which is sort of the southern interior of British Columbia. I don't know that it has an arc per se. I think of it more in terms of a presence, you know, like I like to let the landscape intrude in the book as much as I possibly could. And in fact, in revisions, a lot of the work was paring down, like basically like trimming these hedges, you know, taking away a lot of the botanical kind of descriptions and like the geographical descriptions that I sometimes went overboard with. So it's definitely a presence in the story. I wanted the natural world to be always kind of coming in from the perimeter on each page.
Before we get to the corollary question, I'm going to go ahead and set up the giveaway. So if you want to win a copy of The Other Valley, go ahead and put exclamation point Valley in the chat. And in about 5 minutes, we will draw a winner with the magic of the bot. So the corollary question was, how did the setting impact the characters and plot? Did they all come together or did one come after the other?
So the world came first in this case. I had this idea kind of out of nowhere. As I described, the book is sort of about grief in some ways. And I was, it was a few days before a friend of mine passed away. She was in hospice. So it was something that we were kind of waiting for. And I remember sitting at my table and suddenly having this image that felt random to me at the time. It was just this endless sequence of repeating towns. I don't think the valleys existed yet, but that came pretty fast after that. Yeah, and the basic idea was just, okay, a physical landscape that is kind of eternity where every town is staggered by a certain amount of years. And I had that thought a few years before I had any thoughts about the characters of the stories. I was still a full-time academic. It's super time-consuming, so I didn't... I would jot a note down about it, and every time I would come back to that idea, I'd think, oh, it's kind of cool. You know, I should maybe try to write that someday. Maybe it'll be a screenplay or something. But I had that world for a long time before I started to seriously think about writing this as a novel. And when I did, I would just write these little vignettes each day. Like, I have a good sense of the world. I'm going to now just explore one character for, you know, 500 words and just see what happens. Just try to meet somebody that I'm interested in following further. And after a few of these, I found this girl who was, you know, deathly shy, didn't talk to anybody, just stood, you know, beside the wall of the school every day while everybody else was, you know, out there with their friends. And I, you know, I'm kind of just like a bird watcher outside of the story, being like, okay, she looks interesting. I want to find out why she does this. You know, why doesn't she know anybody? What's her backstory? And so it kind of just went from there. But yeah, it was definitely the landscape and the world was first in this case.
Interesting. Coming up, figuring out the first thing is always a challenge for me, or usually figuring out which came first or which needs to come first, I suppose. So the book you're working on now, is this a sequel, or do you have any other plans for a sequel or other characters, or are you going off on a completely new path? And I know not a lot of people like to talk about their works in progress, so give as much or little information as you feel comfortable.
I think, so the second book is not a sequel. It's not related to it. I think that, you know, with film and TV, a lot of things obviously have to go right for something to ever be made and for a thing that gets made to go on for another season. So this is, you know, extremely unlikely in the grand statistical scheme of things. But if the show got picked up, that's based on The Other Valley, I do have ideas of where that story could go, mm-hmm. you know, and I think I'm kind of willing to sort of seed any sort of further unspooling of the action to kind of the adaptation. At this point, I don't plan to write a sequel, but I can imagine sort of a sequel happening if the show was to go on. I think as far as my new book goes, rather than talk about the substance of it, I think I'm happy to talk about the challenges.
Sure, please.
Of writing about this stuff. I feel so. I saw. Do you know the German writer Jenny Erpenbeck?
No.
She's somebody who I really admire. It's a very idiosyncratic way of writing. Her voices are so interesting. And I saw her at a festival a few months ago, and I was kind of heartened to hear that she had the same problem that I do, which is that she says she starts every book like 50 times. You know, she's at the start of the book. She's like, okay, I'm going to start it this way. And she goes for a little bit, and then she thinks, no, I've got to start it this way. And I kind of feel like I'm sort of doing that same thing right now, where I'm kind of always nibbling the edge of the cookie and not kind of chomping to the center of the cookie as quickly as I should be. I kind of continue to sort of rotate the cookie and nibble some more from the perimeter. And at some point, you do just have to kind of make a go of getting right to the meat of what you want to say. Just because even if it's bad, then you have something to kind of build off of and revise and rewrite. You know, like I'm just trying to convince myself to go all the way through it, because I've rewritten starts to this so many times. And I have so much of the arc already mapped out, but I kind of continue to not get to it. So that's the big challenge right now, is just like, in a way, having written the first book, I now know how much work it is. And so my brain is telling me, oh, it'd be great if you could just save yourself the time and just write it really well for the first time, rather than the very inefficient kind of method that I used the first time, which is to write it poorly and then write it a little bit less poorly. But I don't think there's a way of getting around that process. So, yeah, again, the perils of foreknowledge.
I'm very sorry about that. I thought my kid would take care of it, and turns out my kid's taking a nap, or trying to take a nap. Probably not anymore, because the dog was yelling a lot. Very sorry. Yes, hounds must be appeased. A lot of people want to ask questions about your bird watching mentality, but we're going to take a moment and pick the winner. There, just that button. Who do we have? Foreigner! Congratulations, Foreigner. I will get the book of The Other Valley out to you. If you want to whisper or email me your address, where to send it. Unfortunately, it's not signed, but, you know, you should follow Scott on book tour. Are you doing a book tour?
Not really. No.
Okay.
You can find me online. I'm on Instagram, at Scott Alexander Howard.
Cool.
And that's sort of the main place where I'm active.
Well, excellent. The Kids Are Asleep wants to know how many of these bird-watched characters made it into the book.
Several. It's been a while, so now I don't fully remember the ones who got killed off. But some of them changed form. But I would say that quite a lot of the original people, in some way or another, have persisted to the final draft. Who ended up in the actual book. So maybe of those original of that original crop, maybe like four. And it's a book with a fairly small cast of characters. Like there's a lot of side people, but the main core is pretty small.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we have reached the end of all my questions. If you in chat want to ask any more questions, ask them now. What are you reading these days, Scott?
I'm reading right now Martin McInnes in Ascension. which is a big sci-fi book. We share a British publisher, so I got sent a copy of that, and I'm enjoying it. It's much more. The thing about my book is that it's like sci-fi without any sci in it. Like, there's no scientific explanation or otherwise as to how this world works. The explanations are mostly about the politics of guarding these borders. So it's kind of interesting for me to read a very heavy sci-fi book in terms of the sci content. You know, it's like a lot of stuff about biology. So yeah, it's been nice.
Well, cool. It looks like we are done with the questions. Thank you so much for being on the show. Tell us again where to find you online, please.
Yeah, it's on Instagram. It's at Scott Alexander Howard. And my website is also just my name, scottalexanderhoward.com.
Great. And you guys know you can find me at merverse.com or mightymer@gmail.com. And I stream this show Tuesdays, Thursdays, 3 o'clock on twitch.tv/mightymer. So thank you, Scott. The book is The Other Valley, and it is excellent. I'm just had trouble putting it down so I could do this interview, actually. So I think you guys will enjoy it. And I'll see you guys next week. And until then, you should be writing.
Thank you for listening to I Should Be Writing, the longest running writing podcast in existence. This episode was made possible by the Fabulists, who support the podcast via Patreon or Substack. Join the Fabulists at patreon.com/mightymer or mightymer.substack.com. Theme music provided by John Anilio, art provided by Numbers Ninja, and podcast hosting provided by Libsyn. This episode is released under Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives 4.0 license. You can find all of my books and podcasts at merverse.com.